My name is Dr. Gary Collins. I'm a clinical psychologist and a faculty member in the Department of Psychology and Counseling at Trinity Evangelical Divinity School in Deerfield, Illinois. This is a tape about the crises of life. This tape is not meant to replace a counselor, to answer all of your questions, or to solve your problems for you, but it is intended as a supplement to your counseling, an added plus which your counselor would like you to hear and to discuss sometime later in a counseling session. We hope that this tape will be helpful to you. We know that tapes can be helpful when people listen to them carefully. And on this tape, I would like to talk with you about some special stresses that come into all of our lives at times. If you or a friend are now facing a crisis, you know that it isn't easy. If you're undergoing a crisis, you may feel confused, hurt, lonely, sad, overwhelmed, and tired. It may be that you're angry, perhaps with others, perhaps with yourself, maybe even with God. It's possible that you're inefficient, not getting your work done as well as you might have otherwise. Perhaps you're impatient, hard to get along with, and having difficulty in getting along with others. It's possible that a lot of your energy is directed towards meeting this crisis of life, so that you don't always think straight and you don't always think wisely. One of the reasons for this is that as we go through life, most of us have learned to behave in fairly consistent ways. Oh, there are emotional and spiritual ups and downs, of course, and at times we've got to put forth a little extra effort to deal with emergencies and unexpected problems. But as we approach adulthood, each of us develops our own little group of problem-solving techniques. These techniques are based on our personality, training, and past experience. We use these coping techniques repeatedly, and these enable us to meet the challenges of life successfully. There are times, however, when situations arise which are more severe, which are unique, and which need to be treated in somewhat of a different way. These situations or life events are known as crises. They may be expected or unexpected, real or imagined, actual, as when a loved one dies, or potential, as when it appears that a loved one might die. Several writers have pointed out that the Chinese word for crisis involves two characters. One of these characters means danger. The other means opportunity. A crisis is a danger because it threatens to overwhelm us. Crises involve the loss of someone or something very significant. They may involve the sudden shift in our role or status, the appearance of some new or threatening circumstance or individual. Because the crisis situation is so intense and so unique, we discover that our customary ways of handling stress and solving problems no longer work. This leaves us confused and bewildered, and often our behavior becomes inefficient. There are emotional outbursts at times. Sometimes we're upset emotionally, so we experience anxiety and anger and discouragement and sorrow and perhaps guilt. Although all of this may last for a very short period of time, it can go on for several months or even longer. Crises are dangerous then, but they also present us with opportunities. Opportunities to change and to grow and to develop some new and better ways of coping. Since people in crises often feel confused, they're often more open to outside help, including the kind of help that comes from a counselor, the kind of help that comes from a tape, and hopefully the kind of help that comes from God. When doctors talk about a medical crisis, they often refer to the crucial point in time when there is a change, either towards improvement and recovery, or towards decline and death. Now, emotional and spiritual crises are somewhat the same. They are unavoidable turning points in life. To live is to experience crises. To experience crises is to face turning points, which will bring either growth and maturation or deterioration and continuing immaturity. In order to bring about growth and to avoid the immaturity, I think it would help if we could look at some of the types of crises and then look at some ways in which we can face crises. This is what we'll be doing on the first side of this tape. Let us begin first by looking at some types of crises. Contemporary psychologists and other writers have suggested that there are three kinds of crises, each of which we all experience at times, and each of which has some biblical examples. The first type of crisis is what we might call the accidental or situational crises. It is something which comes suddenly. Suddenly there's a threat or an unexpected loss. A loved one dies. A sudden illness comes about. We experience rape. We discover a pregnancy out of wedlock. There is a war or economic depression. Perhaps we lose our homes in a fire or in a storm. Our savings disappear. There is a discovery that a child whom we loved and waited for is severely retarded or diseased. These are situational stresses, many of which were seen in the Old Testament. Do you remember Job? Within a short period of time, he lost his family, his wealth, his health, and his status. In addition, his marriage appears to have been strained, and he experienced considerable confusion, anger, and inner turmoil. Accidental crises are very common. But so are the second type of crisis, developmental crises. They happen during the course of normal human development, and they come into our lives when we grow from one stage of life to another, starting school, going away to college, adjusting to marriage, learning to become a parent, handling criticism, facing retirement, adapting to the death of our friends, finding that we have declining health. All of these can be crises which demand new ways of coping and new ways to solve problems. Do you remember Abraham and Sarah in the Old Testament? They coped with moving, with many years of criticism, with childlessness, with family stress, and they even had to cope with the command of God that the young Isaac should be sacrificed. We might wonder how an elderly couple like Zacharias and Elizabeth handled a son so unique as John the Baptist, or how Mary and Joseph, probably relatively young themselves, were able to raise one so unusual and brilliant as the boy Jesus. Surely these were developmental crises, turning points which demanded prolonged periods of wise decision-making, but which also led to increased growth and probably a lot of stress. The third type of crises have been called existential crises. That is a complicated word, but we could probably call them life-meaning crises. Very often they overlap with the developmental crises, but life-meaning or existential crises come when suddenly we are forced to face something that we've been trying to avoid. I'm a failure. I'm too old to reach my life goals. I've been passed over for a promotion. I am now a widow. I'm single again. My life has no purpose. My marriage has ended in divorce. My illness is incurable. I really don't have anything to believe in. My house and everything I own is gone in the fire. I'm retired. I'm rejected because of the color of my skin. These and similar realizations take a lot of time and effort to assimilate. They are changes in the pictures that we have of ourselves. We can deny them temporarily, but in time they must be faced realistically. So you might think for a minute or two about the crises that you are facing right now. Do your crises fit one of these three categories? Whether or not you can fit your crisis into one of these three categories, perhaps it would be helpful for you to think about some ways in which you can face crises. I have 8 suggestions that I would like to make for helping you to face the crises that are in your life right now. The first suggestion is this: accept the fact that the crisis has occurred. At times, almost all of us play mental games to defend ourselves and to keep ourselves from facing the unpleasant realities of life. We overlook bad news, for example. We ignore evidence that indicates that a crisis has arisen. Sometimes we'll deny the truth in a situation. We convince ourselves that God will make everything all right, and therefore we go about as if the bad news had never been given to us. Paul Tonnier, who is a well-known Swiss counselor, once suggested that if we're ever going to deal with a problem in life, the first step that we must take is to accept the fact that the crisis has occurred. In my reading and in my counseling, it has occurred to me that there are probably two general kinds of crises. We might call them the socially approved crises and the socially unapproved crises. The socially approved crises come when you lose a loved one through death, when your house burns down, when you lose your money, when somebody in your family has a serious illness. At that time, everybody comes around you. People from the church and community come by to help, and this can be very supportive. The crisis is not easy, but at least other people in the community accept the fact that it has occurred, and it helps you to face the reality of the crisis. But then there are the unapproved crises. Suppose your teenage daughter gets pregnant before she's married. Your son is arrested on a drug charge. Your marriage breaks up. You are involved in some kind of illegal activity. These things may bring great regret and great turmoil in your life, but other people take a hush-hush attitude. They don't want to talk to you about the crisis. They try to avoid the subject when they see you. And now you are faced with a crisis, and you have the additional problem of not having anyone with whom you can face it honestly. Sometimes it's harder to accept those kinds of crises. But whether your crisis is approved by the society or unapproved, they are real crises nevertheless. And the first way that you can deal with this crisis is to honestly accept the fact that the crisis has occurred. A second suggestion for dealing with crises is to accept the fact that you need other people. When I was a college student, we had a member of our class who was blind. I remember talking with him one day. During his time in high school, he had sight, but at the end of high school, for some reason, he lost his sight. He decided to go to college anyhow and took his notes in Braille. People helped him walk around the campus, and he graduated with better grades than most of us who had all of our eyesight. But he said to me one day, "Gary, one of the things that I've had to learn is that if I'm going to go to college, I have to depend on other people. I need other people to help me to get through college." At times in our lives, each one of us needs other people. We need other people, especially in times of crises. We need people to help us gain an objective perspective, to give us guidance, comfort, help, rest, and practical assistance. What is interesting is that many times other people want to help us. They find a certain joy in caring for us and in giving to us. Sometimes when we say to them, "No, thank you, I can do it by myself," we are refusing to give these people the privilege of giving to us. Sometimes in the midst of crises, it is good for us and for them to let other people help us. Sometimes it might be humbling for you, but humility is a real mark of a Christian. And in the Bible, again and again, we read the words, "one another." We are to love one another, help one another, support one another, give to one another, help one another, encourage one another. And if somebody else wants to help you, you have a responsibility as a Christian to accept this kind of help. We need to recognize that in times of crises, we need one another. A third suggestion to help you in times of crises is to accept and express your feelings. Let's begin by reminding ourselves that we have God-given feelings. Even Jesus got angry, cried, and probably laughed. I suspect he expressed the whole range of human emotions because during his time on earth he was in a human body. Several times in the New Testament, the attitude of the Stoics is condemned. These are the people, you will remember, who kept on denying feelings and thinking that it was somehow super spiritual to hide their feelings. If you go to a counselor, you will probably find that the counselor is accepting and encouraging you to honestly express your feelings. God knows about your feelings, and He's not displeased with the fact that you have these feelings. I believe we need to share our feelings with somebody who is significant, certainly with God, perhaps with a counselor, perhaps with one or two other people who love us and care for us. If you're undergoing a crisis, please don't deny your feelings. A fourth suggestion for dealing with a crisis is that we should talk about issues. In times of crises, it's easy to be overwhelmed by what appears to be a mass of confusing facts and problem situations. We need to look at the specific issues that we need to face, the actual problems which must be solved. Perhaps your counselor can help you to do this. Try and focus on the situation that is bringing a crisis into your life right now. What is there about it which is difficult for you to handle? What specifically could you do about it? The more specific you can get in handling your crises, the better. Fifth, you can ask yourself this question: what can be done realistically to deal with my crises? What action can I take? What specific things can I do to make life as full and as complete now? If you've got a retarded child, for example, you need to pick up where you are and recognize that your life might be different, but you go on and live life as full as possible with that retarded child in your home. If you have lost your possessions, it's important for you to pick up and start again. I remember one time arriving in Omaha, Nebraska, a few hours after a serious tornado had taken out a number of buildings. I stayed in the town for several days on some business, and towards the end of my visit, we drove through the tornado area. There was a house in that area that had been completely destroyed except for one wall. On that wall, somebody had taken a can of black spray paint and written the fact that this family will build again. These people had lost just about everything, but they were going to take the steps they needed to rebuild and continue living life to the fullest. Suppose you are one of those people who have been raped. This is a traumatic experience, but you can spend the rest of your life living in the trauma. Instead, with God's help, and with the help of friends, including our counselors, we must stop and ask ourselves, granted that the crisis has occurred, what specifically can I do now to live the life that God wants me to live? A sixth suggestion is to ask yourself, what must I accept as unchangeable? This is very difficult in a crisis, because sometimes it must be recognized that in some crisis situations, there are changes that we cannot do anything about. If you lose a loved one in death, or if you discover the existence of an incurable disease, or if you fail to attain an important promotion, this may make a permanent change in your life. You must learn to face this situation honestly. Acknowledge and express your feelings. Readjust your lifestyle if necessary, and realistically plan for the future. Rest in the knowledge that God in His sovereignty knows about your pain and cares. In all crises, but especially in times of permanent change, it helps if you can be surrounded by some sincere, concerned, helpful, praying friends who are available to assist and to show you love whenever they are needed. A seventh way in which you can deal with crises is to challenge your self-defeating ideas. Lots of times, we get ideas in our minds following a crisis, ideas that make life more difficult for us. An idea which says, nothing could be worse than what has happened to me. I'll never get better. I'll never be happy again. This is the end of a meaningful existence for me. Now, it's easy to think like that in times of crises, but such ideas need to be challenged after a while. What evidence is there for the conclusion that you'll never get better, that life will never be happy again, that there will never be any meaning or purpose in your life? If we have a God who cares for us and provides for us, then we have hope. For the Christian, there is always hope, and we must be careful not to wallow in self-defeating ideas. And this brings us to our eighth suggestion. We need to get moving again. Do you know of people who constantly live in the past or in the future? I know of students who talk about the fact that life will be good when they get their degree, when they get married, when they get their first job, when they get a promotion. These people are always living in the future and never doing anything to make life meaningful in the present. I think we have got to plan for the future, but live in the present. Maybe there are some specific things that we can do to get moving again, some specific steps that we can take so that our future really will be happier and our present can be more fulfilling too. Several years ago, some psychologists came up with something which they called the helper therapy principle. Several years ago, some professional counselors came up with an interesting observation about helping ourselves. They said that one of the best ways to help yourself is to help other people. Most of us are familiar with Alcoholics Anonymous, that organization where people with a drinking problem reach out to help others who have a drinking problem. Members of Alcoholics Anonymous often mention that one of the things that has helped them most with their drinking problem is to reach out to help somebody else who has a similar problem. The same thing could happen to you. If you're struggling with a crisis, at some time, perhaps not now, but at some time soon, you ought to think about how you can reach out to touch and help somebody else. How can you improve the life of some other person because of your having been through this crisis? These, then, are several suggestions, 8 of them, for dealing with a crisis. If you look on the growth sheet that you have been given, you will notice that there are some questions about this first side of the tape on crises. What has this tape taught you about crises in your own life? Having heard the tape, can you write down some practical steps that you might take to meet your crises? Why don't you take the time to answer these questions on paper? Do so now before turning the tape over and listening to side 2. On side 1 of this tape, we spend some time talking about crises, the kind of crises that you might be experiencing in your life. We talked about the common nature of crises, the fact that crises give us both danger and opportunity. We mentioned 3 types of crises, and then we suggested 8 ways in which we can deal with crises. At the end of the tape, we suggested that you might answer some questions about crises in your own life. As we turn to side 2 of this tape, I would like you to take some time to think further about the crises in your life. Would you please take a piece of paper and divide it into 4 columns? On your tape guide sheet, there is an example of what we are hoping for you to do. At the top of column 1, write, "Describe your crisis situation or situations." At the top of column 2, write, "What have you done to help?" At the top of column 3, "What have you done which didn't help?" And at the top of column 4, write, "What have you learned about crises?" You will notice that we have some numbers there. 1, 2, 3. In the first column, I would like you to write down each crisis that you are having. Perhaps it's only 1. Perhaps it's 2 or 3. Then, I would like to suggest that you take the time to look at each of these crises. Think of the crisis that will be listed as number 1. What have you done on your own that has enabled you to deal with this crisis? Something that has really been helpful. Then in the next column, you can write what you have done that hasn't helped you very much. And in the last column, you can jot down what you have learned about crises and about crises in your own life. It would be helpful if you would complete this activity right now. Please draw up a sheet similar to what we have described, stop the tape, and fill it out. Let's think now about a family that I know who, by all external appearances, was a stable, happy, well-adjusted family. They were very active in their church, and all of the children had confessed Christ as Savior and seemed to be on their way to developing individual, successful, and rewarding careers. Jim and Sharon were out of college, and Joan was finishing her studies at the university. Things were going along well as usual, until Joan came home one weekend and tearfully announced to the family that she was pregnant. This was a tremendous shock to the entire family. It was a crisis. They didn't quite know how to react. And as the reality of the crisis hit home, Mrs. Smith, the mother, began to cry uncontrollably. What had they done wrong? How had they failed as parents? Joan tried to reassure them that they had been good as parents, and that she and Keith, her boyfriend, had not been responsible in their physical relationship. They knew that. After much counsel, prayer, and discussion, Joan and Keith eventually decided that although this mistake had happened, they still wanted to get married. In this case, they decided to get married, and were married 2 months later. Joan's college career had to end prematurely, but they had decided that she could attempt to finish her work after the baby arrived. Have you ever had a crisis like this in your life? What major crises have you experienced recently? On your guide sheet, there are some questions that might help you to think about these crises. Have you developed any self-defeating attitudes in dealing with your crises? Are there things that you can do now to adjust to the crises? Are there things that must be accepted as unchangeable? And what are your feelings now about the crises? Have you ever wondered, why me? Perhaps you would like to stop the tape and answer these questions, and after that, we'll come back and talk about this difficult question of why me. Right now, stop the tape and answer those questions. Whenever we experience a crisis in life, most of us struggle with the basic question of why. Why me? Why did I have this crisis? Why did I get into this difficult situation? Why am I suffering? Well, for centuries, Christians have struggled with this problem, the problem of pain and the meaning of suffering. It's the problem of why. I suppose these Christians over the years have concluded that God's ways are far too deep for our little brains to comprehend. Certainly, we can only get a limited glimpse of the answers we seek, but the Scriptures, nevertheless, and our own research, lead us to several understandings of why crises come about. First, we suffer and have crises because we're part of the human race. Pain comes at times because we never exercise, don't eat properly, fail to take care of ourselves, or come into contact with some kind of a virus or disease. When this happens, it's good to remember that God, who is all-knowing, recognizes everything about our suffering. Nothing is permitted to happen without His awareness. We see this clearly in the book of Job, when Satan used his supernatural but limited powers to bring suffering into the life of Job, but only after God, in His wisdom, had permitted it to happen. A second reason for suffering is sin. When our ancestors first disobeyed God, sin entered the world, and with it came pain and suffering. This became part of the human condition. All hurting, therefore, comes ultimately because of mankind's sinful condition. But when an individual suffers, somebody like you and me, is that the result of deliberate sin in our lives? Well, it would seem that pain sometimes does come because of sin in the sufferer's life. But this isn't always true. In fact, most of the time it seems that it isn't true. We all know of people who live in great sin without apparent suffering. And we know of others, like Job, who live exemplary lives but still suffer. In several places, the Bible refutes the popular idea that suffering is always the result of the sufferer's own sin. In John 9, for example, the disciples ask Jesus about a man who had been born blind. Perhaps with a little bit of an air of superiority, they asked, "Who sinned, Lord, this man or his parents?" And Jesus bluntly replied that neither had sinned, and that God was not punishing this man or his family through illness, as the disciples had assumed. The same idea was expressed in Luke 13, when Jesus was told about some Galileans who apparently had died as part of a heathen sacrifice, or about some other men who had been killed when a tower fell on them at a place named Siloam. "Do you suppose," Jesus said, "that these Galileans were greater sinners than all other Galileans because they suffered this fate? Do you suppose," he continued, "that those people on whom the tower fell were worse culprits than the other men who live in Jerusalem?" Jesus didn't give them time to answer. He answered his own questions with a resounding no. It cannot be assumed that tragedy, suffering, and pain are punishments which indicate that God is displeased with the sufferer. Sometimes, as with the 10 plagues in Egypt, suffering does come as punishment. But other times, as with the case of Job, there is no reason to believe that God is punishing us through suffering, or that he is trying to tell us something by bringing pain into our lives. A third reason for suffering is that it helps us to grow and mature. The Apostle James, in James chapter 1, verses 2 to 4, told us to consider it all joy when we encounter various trials, knowing, he said, that the testing of your faith produces endurance, and that endurance helps to make us more mature. In 2 Corinthians 12, verses 7 through 10, the Apostle Paul talks about a problem that he had. It was a thorn in the flesh, which never left Paul in spite of his continual prayers. Paul accepted this discomfort. I don't suppose he liked it, but he accepted it because it kept him from exalting himself. He said, "It has taught me to depend on God, and it has shown me that we human beings are strong only when we acknowledge our weakness and commit our lives to God." Elsewhere in the New Testament, we read that suffering refines our faith, conforms us to Christ's image, makes us more Christ-like, teaches us about God, and produces both perseverance and character. There was one time when things were pretty difficult in the life of the prophet Jeremiah. He prayed for protection, and God replied by telling the prophet to go over and watch a vessel being made on the potter's wheel. Jeremiah went and watched as the clay was pounded, torn apart, pushed back together, and eventually molded into a vessel of beauty, which was then placed into a hot oven. God does that to us, sometimes molding us like pottery into that which is strong and beautiful and useful. He does this not because he's lacking in compassion. He does it because he loves us, like the father who refuses to let his child run out into the busy street, but disciplines the child to help him or her understand that some things are forbidden for one's own benefit. At the time, such discipline isn't appreciated, but afterwards the child can see that it was necessary for his or her own protection and growth. In like manner, God sometimes trains us in ways that are not pleasant to us, and it is only later that we can see how the discipline made us stronger and more Christ-like. Following this tape, you may want to turn in your Bible to Hebrews chapter 12 and read verses 5 through 12, because it's there that God talks about suffering and how it can make us more Christ-like. Closely connected with this is a fourth reason for suffering. It enables us to be more caring. The person who has suffered is often more sympathetic and better able to help others who are in need. Paul mentioned this at the beginning of his second letter to the Corinthians. When we suffer, he wrote, we are better able to understand and to comfort others who are suffering. But what about you? Does this make you feel any better? Perhaps we can understand a little bit, only a little bit, why we suffer, but this doesn't make it easier. There was a song one time that said, the hard times make us strong, and I suspect that's true, but that doesn't make the hard times easier. It's difficult to be in a crisis. On this tape, we've talked about crises, their types, the ways we can deal with them, about the crises in your life, and some of the ways in which we can try to understand why crises come into our lives. Hopefully this can be a start towards helping you to overcome the crises in your life. Don't forget, when this tape is finished, to return it to your counselor and to talk with him about what you have learned from this tape. When you go back to your counselor, take along any notes that you may have written or growth activities that you may have completed while listening to this tape. The examples on this tape are either fictitious or used with the permission of the people involved. Any resemblance to people that you might know is purely a coincidence.